are listening to Justice Radio on WMPG. My name is Emily Goulet from Maine Indigent Defense Center, and today we are speaking with Bob Black, a student at Maine Law and an intern at our office this summer. Bob, do you want to introduce yourself?
Sure, yeah. I am Bob Black. As Emily said, I'm an intern at Maine Indigent Defense Center. I'm a 3L, our third year law student at University of Maine School of Law in Portland. I came into law school really very interested in labor law and employment law. I've done a fair amount of labor organizing in the nonprofit sector, and that's kind of what made me want to go to law school. Once I got to Maine Law, I got pretty involved with Students for the Sixth Amendment, which is a student organization where the goal of the organization is to establish, there are several, but one of the major ones is to establish public defender's offices in every county of Maine. Currently, there are not public defender's offices in all of Maine. There are only, I believe, three or four in some of the more northern counties, northern and central counties. So I got interested through some friends that I had that were in that group. And after reading more into the current indigent defender crisis in Maine, I got more interested and wanted to help and started to take more criminal law courses. And I'm still very interested in labor and employment law, but I think that my focus has shifted in terms of what I want to do on the day-to-day more towards criminal law. And so I applied for the internship with Maine Indigent Defense Center this summer. I was very excited to get it. And now I'm much more solidly on a track towards practicing criminal law in Maine.
Awesome. And what Bob is talking to us about today is a good crossover of both of those interests. So I'm super excited to hear about it, but I will let him introduce what he's going to be chatting with us about.
Thanks, Emily. Yeah. So what I'm going to be talking about today is the state of the public/indigent defense crisis throughout the country. It's not just a Maine issue. In many states throughout the country, they are really struggling to find attorneys to take indigent cases. Many states that have a deficit of public defenders. And in some of those states, just how things have kind of played out, some of those states have unions, some of those unions have a lot of motion and have been very successful lately. I'll be talking a bit about that, but I'll also be talking about attempts made from lawmakers, from advocates to try to remedy this situation that is very complex and not unique to Maine.
Can you start, back it up a little bit and just start by explaining how a union works for anybody that doesn't know?
Sure. A labor union is a group of workers that organizes together to fight for things like better pay, for benefits. Essentially, labor unions were born in the late 19th century into early 20th century in the U.S., and it was at a time when there were no real regulations. There was child labor. There was people working 16-hour days in horribly dangerous conditions. So people realized that the only way to get better conditions was to organize and to use strength in numbers to form a group or a union that is recognized and can have serious negotiating power. So I think that a lot of people's conception of what unions are just for blue collar, labor type unions, because that's traditionally what they've been in the U.S. But now a lot of the motion in the organizing community is in more white collar jobs, social services, nonprofits, even office jobs. So that is a major development over the last few decades. And it is very exciting. And not a lot of people, I think a lot of people don't know that unions can exist outside of blue collar work. So
what's the reason that it expanded to those jobs?
I think that largely it was that we became, sort of a post-industrial country, that now most of the workforce is not in jobs in, mining coal or steel or even jobs, even the trades. We are much more now of a service economy than we are a manufacturing economy. So I think that is a large reason for, there's just more workers that are in more white collar jobs than there used to be.
So if you're, and I promise I'll let you get to what this has to do with indigent defense, but I'm just wondering what are people speaking in those types of unions? Because, you know, we're here in the office, we don't have dangerous conditions. So what kind of things are they negotiating for?
It's a great question. So many, many things. It's very dependent upon the union, but some of the very common needs of workers that are not in, you know, blue collar jobs are a living wage. You know, regardless of the fact that we have a lot more regulations and our jobs may not be as physically dangerous, a living wage is a big one. Full benefits is another big one. Having a say in terms of the policy, in terms of depending on the workplace, there are a lot of factors. But the big ones, I think, for us, for social services, one of the biggest, again, is pay. And I'll get more into that later. And it is not just that people in social services need to make more money just because. It's more that a lot of these positions are very hard to fill. And then when someone who is an advocate and really wants to help starts working somewhere and doesn't make enough money to even pay their, you know, basic amenities, they're going to have to go somewhere else. And that's, you know, I think a problem that we're seeing across the country, especially in nonprofit, public sector, social services jobs.
So it's helping us keep people in those positions.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. So why do we in Indigent Defense care about the unions?
We care about the unions in Indigent Defense because currently we're having that exact same problem in almost every, I wouldn't say every state. There are some states that have very robust public defender systems, but in a lot of states, we're having that exact same problem where the pay isn't high enough to where people will actually stay. For instance, in Massachusetts, the rate for what they call bar advocates or, you know, private attorneys that take on indigent court-appointed cases, the rate is $65 an hour, which sounds to a person who's a non-lawyer to just, you know, it's well above the average income, which sounds great.
Oh, 65. What state did you say that was?
This is Massachusetts.
Okay.
So of the six New England states, Massachusetts, which has the highest cost of living, has a rate for bar advocates that is less than half or about half of the average for the rest of the five states. Mm-hmm. Every other state has a rate between 110 and 150. So anyway, Massachusetts is having a lot of problems, I'm sure some people have seen in the news, retaining bar advocates, people that are willing to take on these cases. And as a result of that, over the last couple months, there have been well over 100 cases that have been thrown out. There have been a few dozen people that have been let out of jail, you know, mostly nonviolent offenders, because
they're throwing out the case because there's nobody to represent them.
Correct. Yeah. And most of these cases are being thrown out, to my knowledge, without prejudice, which means that the prosecutor can recharge later if they want or refile. But the fact of the matter is just that it's happening in a lot of states, not necessarily that cases are getting thrown out, but that people are going out without representation for several weeks, several months, even in some cases more than a year. Anyway,
they're dismissing the case. But essentially, you know, when we have counsel again, we'll come back to this and you're just leaving people with this hanging over their heads until maybe they do get counsel and they get recharged.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's unclear whether or not these cases will be charged again or what will happen there. Going back to the $65 an hour, you know, it sounds great to most people. And it is. It is if you don't have student loan debt. Another thing that is not often considered, say people that are able to get free tuition, they're still living expense loans. It's almost impossible to work a 40-hour a week full-time job while in law school. So that's like often another $60,000 to $80,000 on top of student loans. So most of these lawyers are in an incredible amount of debt. They're also living in one of the most expensive cities in the country. And there are also many other fields of law, not to throw shade at other areas of law, but that are easier and much higher paying.
And just be, like, say you're in the minority, you know, maybe you had a partner supporting you while you're in school and you didn't have to take any loans for anything. $65 an hour is still, you need an office space, you need malpractice insurance. You know, if you have support staff, any business expenses whatsoever is coming out of that. It's getting depleted almost immediately.
Absolutely.
It's not you putting $65 in your pocket.
That's exactly right. Yeah. And I was going to, I think, address that a little bit more later. Yes, that's exactly, you know, obviously on top of that, it's taxed, but you need, in most states, you need to have some type of office space. You need to have a space where you can meet with clients. And, you know, in most cities, especially Boston, I imagine Portland too, if you want an office space near the courthouse, that's you know, in
Outrageous.
yeah,
Just, yeah.
insane amount of money. So yeah, there are a lot of factors that go into it. That's a very good point. You're not walking away with 65, you know. Yes. That's just for Massachusetts. You know, for people, I think what the bottom line is this. People can have their own opinions about, oh, 65 an hour, it's plenty of money, whatever else, but at the end of the day, these defendants are going to go unrepresented. So, you know, as much as you can think, as much as you want that lawyers are being greedy or they should be in public defense for, you know, because it's a righteous cause or whatever else, but and there are quite a lot of lawyers that are doing this just because they feel like it's the right thing to do. No one's doing it to get rich.
People
But
working for a righteous cause still need to pay their bills.
100%, 100%. I think that regardless of what people think, this is going to keep happening unless there are major changes that are made, not just in terms of money, but other, you know, structural changes to the system, then lawyers just aren't going to take cases and clients are going to continue to go unrepresented.
I'm going to pause you there, and we'll come back to this in a minute. You're listening to Justice Radio with Emily Goulette and Bob Black. We are talking about the intersection of labor law and indigent defense. Well, I'll let you continue what you were talking about.
Sure, yeah. So I talked a little bit about Massachusetts. I would like to just talk a little bit about some other states, what they're going through, and you know, attempts that are being made to fix the system. I think that that is one of the major issues is that, you know, I was talking with one of my close friends recently who works in indigent defense, and she was saying, you know, if you ask 10 different people that are experts, people that have been working in indigent defense in Maine for many years, what the problem is and what the solution is, you'll get 10 different answers. And I find that to be true just when I've been talking to people about kind of just preparing for this interview. It is a very convoluted topic, and I am definitely not an expert in it. I'm very new to it, and I am just trying to sort of get a better idea of what the problems are here, what the problems are other places, and how other places have been successful and not successful in dealing with those problems. So Oregon has a pretty bad problem right now with unrepresented defendants. They have, as of about a week ago, they have over 4,000 that are currently waiting for an attorney. So there was a new bill that was recently approved that's been fairly controversial. So the bill allocates over $700 million to boost the public defense for the Oregon Public Defense Commission. One of the more controversial aspects of this is that the plan will allow experienced defenders to push their caseload beyond the current maximum limit, but it won't be mandatory. So there is some positive side to that. Probably the most negative aspect of the plan, in my own opinion, is that it will allow the state to cut the pay or even potentially fire any defenders, even new defenders, who the state believes aren't taking on enough cases.
Wow.
Yeah, which I
And
don't
so
think.
Oregon, correct me if I'm wrong, but Oregon maybe a little over a year ago was the first place to have an official order that they were releasing people that didn't have counsel. So those don't seem to go together.
I think that that is one of the most glaring aspects of the bill that I think is maybe not universally disliked, but that I think can cause some problems. You definitely don't want to overwork new attorneys, especially because it is a field that can be so overwhelming and can burn people out so quickly. I think that an additional, you know, threat over your head that if you're not taking up enough cases, or if the state decides we don't think you're taking enough cases, they can fire you. I think it will pressure people into taking more cases than they're comfortable taking.
It also feels like you're saying, okay, we don't have counsel for you, so we'll release you, but our answer is that we're going to just overload these attorneys, and in turn, you're just getting, subpar services for these clients, which means we don't care if they're getting good counsel. We just need to have somebody's name on there so we don't have to release them.
Absolutely. That's happening in a lot of states. I mean, including Maine, where there's a push from the governor's office to kind of ease up restrictions on caseloads and allow attorneys to take more cases. But yeah, I think that the caseloads that are currently in place by the Maine Commission for Public Defense Services, MCPDS, are reasonable. And I think that for an experienced attorney, I think in Oregon right now, it's about 140 that they can take for that's for serious felonies, for murder, sex crimes. I think they're allowing them to push it to maybe 160. And I think that there is a certain personality type of someone who is extremely competent and wants to always take on more. But I think that the case limits are in place for a reason. So,
and I know places are also looking at trying to get rid of those qualifications for specific case types, which, you know, that's just dangerous in itself. Just because you're a criminal defense attorney doesn't mean that you know anything about OUIs. You know, that's a very specific road to go down that people spend their whole career specializing in. But again, we're just saying we would rather have somebody who doesn't even have the knowledge on this specific case type rather than nobody. And I personally don't agree with the idea that bad counsel would be better than no counsel, especially if no counsel means you're going to be released. Then you would think after that happening long enough, it would force us to then have qualified, effective counsel for everyone that needs it. But instead, it's just forcing ways to try and get around it.
No, absolutely. Yeah. And I mean, that is sort of a big point of contention right now in terms of there is a push from, obviously, as I said, you know, the governor for to make MCPDS's restrictions more lax. And a big part of that is the eligibility. And it actually made me read through all of or most of the bylaws of MCPDS to see, because there's this debate over, oh, their restrictions are way too strict. And then MCPDS and a lot of attorneys that I've talked to saying they're actually not that strict. So I kind of wanted to see.
Yeah, I mean, I think they're very reasonable.
I agree. I think, and there's also waivers. So if an attorney doesn't meet, you know, every single eligibility criteria, that they can make a case for, like, you know, I might not have done this type of case, but I have experience because of this, and, you know, they can have that waived. It's not that long of an application either. And I think there is some misconception that there are a ton of lawyers that are just like waiting, you know, chomping at the bit to take these cases, and that MCPDS is saying like, no, you need to fill out a 10,000 page application and you need to, you know.
And we've talked about that so many times on here, that the news narrative of this crisis is that the headlines always say there's not enough attorneys, and that is wrong. And everyone that we've had on here has said, you know, their different explanation of why that's wrong. And this is just another one.
I think that, the notion that there's so many lawyers that are like being held up by red tape, just that are like, oh, we really want to do this and they're not letting me because this. Yeah, I mean, I think just as you said, you want whoever's representing you to at least know or have practiced a little bit or have knowledge in the field of law that your charge, that the charge against you is.
But unions.
Oh, yeah, we can go back to unions. Sure.
Yes.
I would love to.
Okay, great. So unions and public defense offices, is that where we're going?
Yeah, unions, public defense offices. So the biggest kind of wins lately for public defender unions, which exist in a lot of states, including Maine, even though we have a new from some folks that I've talked to that are working for the public defender, that there is a public defender's union. It is very small. I believe there's from a few different people that I've talked to, some number between like 12 and 20, maybe, at the four different offices. I haven't been able to get an exact number, but...
And they're all, the offices are in this union?
I believe so. That's to my knowledge. Again, I wasn't able to... I also only knew I was doing this. I was talking about unions as of like a week ago. So I'm just, I'm not an expert, and feel free to fact check anything I say, because I, you know, I very well could be wrong, but...
This is a new thing that we haven't talked about yet. So...
Okay, cool.
It's great for me.
Awesome.
Do you know what any of the things that union would be asking for?
I think honestly it depends on who you would talk to. So I obviously haven't been able to get like an official statement or anything, but I think that there are lawyers, public and indigent defense lawyers in Maine, that want there to be a public defenders union in every county. I think that that's probably pretty non-controversial. I think that there is some conflict, some discrepancy, some disagreement on how to get to that point, on how quickly we should, you know, make these offices and expand them. I think that perhaps doing that hastily, just making a ton of offices and just trying to staff them as quickly as possible, could have some downside to it. You know, I think that what you're seeing happening right now is an introduction of a public defender's office, and then still needed to be supplemented by indigent defenders taking on cases, because a lot of these offices only have a couple public, you know, assistant public defenders working there. So I think that probably what you would want to see, or probably what they would want to see, is a raise in pay for public defenders, new offices for public defenders. And yeah, short of that, I don't want to speak too much on what they might want without actually reaching out.
Good to not speculate.
But I can talk about New York City's current semi-strike.
Great, perfect.
Yeah, so there are 9 public defenders organizations in New York City, and 3 of them are represented by the same union, which is the Association of Legal Advocates and Attorneys. So about 750 lawyers and social workers. Also, I thought it was interesting that the Association of Legal Advocates and Attorneys is part of the UAW, the United Automobile Aerospace Agricultural Workers of America. I know there are also some defenders unions that are part of the Teamsters, and I think that's pretty cool.
What are the Teamsters?
Oh, truckers, mostly. And the Teamsters also include a lot of different fields in their shop, but traditionally, the Teamsters were like long-haul truckers or just delivery drivers. The Association of Legal Advocates and Attorneys, they had about 750 people go on strike. Their demands were met within, I believe, a few days. So they didn't have everyone. They believe they just had 20% or so of their union actually start the strike. The Bronx Defenders Attorneys Union, which is around 260 people, they went on strike in July, and their big things that they were trying, their terms that they were trying to win was a floor of 68, I think like around 68,500 floor, and that was for lawyers and non-legal workers or non-attorney workers, social workers. Mm-hmm. They went on strike, I believe, for 3 days on like a Friday. And then by Sunday, their demands were met. So that was a huge victory. There's still, I believe, one union that is on strike. And this was as of a week or week and a half ago. I haven't been able to find where they actually landed. But overall, these two different unions were all able to get their demands met of between 68,500 and 70,000 to start for all attorneys and non-legal workers. The Bronx Defenders Union won, I think, a 3-4% cost of living increase, wage increase per year.
Wow. Which is cool. That's really cool.
Yeah, there were huge wins. They were supposed to be, there was some concern that these would turn into like massive strikes, and there would be, you know, another crisis similar to what New York experienced in the early 90s. Yeah, I think the last thing that I want to talk about, I think we have a few minutes left.
And I have one more question for you, too. It's maybe this is what you're going to say anyway, but I feel like the narrative of unions a lot of times is employers don't want unions because they're going to strike and it's going to be this old. But to me, it feels like, what do you want? I don't know labor law. So, but wouldn't you want your employees to be in a union if it's going to retain your staff?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think there are a lot of reasons. And I think that quite often you will see companies that will fight union efforts extremely strongly, but then after a certain time, they start to embrace the union. I mean, I wouldn't say that in a way where if I was an employee, I would just trust that the management was now on my side and we're all friends. But I will say that they often will display that, you know, we're proudly a union workplace or whatever. And I think that they do end up, there are a lot of benefits to for management and having a union. And it does make a contract, so there's accountability on both sides. You know, I think often management doesn't like accountability on their own side, but you have a contract, right? So it's like there is more accountability for management, so they can't do things like firing without cause. There are a lot of things that management can no longer do. But at the same time, the employee is also being held accountable by that contract. So if they do something that violates the contract, then there's a meeting. It just makes it more of a level, you know, you're a meeting, but you have a union steward with you. You have someone having your back. It's all being recorded. But anyway, yes, I think that a lot of companies do end up benefiting a lot from unions. And I sort of, one of the last things I wanted to say was just that going back to this narrative of, you know, you should be doing this because you want to help people. You shouldn't be doing it to make a lot of money. And especially from management, I've found that a lot of nonprofits, when it comes to unionizing and when it comes to exploiting workers, are often a lot worse than for-profit companies. Mm-hmm. I think that there are many that are great. Often you will see a nonprofit manager trying to say, like, you should want to stay for a 24-hour shift because the person that came in for the next 12-hour shift called out because the clients need you, or you shouldn't be doing this to get rich or to make a lot of money. And people don't realize that there's already a ton of extra work that most social workers put in that they're never going to see a dime for, and they're doing it because they care. But that's not sustainable. And eventually those same people end up burning out super fast and then quitting. And then, if you work somewhere like I've worked in the past, that's client facing, a lot of our clients end up really forming bonds with. I used to work, or I still work in direct care for adults with mental illness. And, a lot of the clients don't have family or friends, and they form a bond with the workers. And then the workers have to leave because they just don't get paid enough. And most of them have, or a lot of them have kids. So then you end up in these really bad cycles of, this is just an example, but, of like, for instance, clients starting to decompensate and starting to do really poorly because their only support system's left. So I think that when you do have a union workplace, and when you have people that feel that you have workers that feel that they have some autonomy, that are making a living wage, that are getting, basic benefits, they want to stick around, and then more people want to work there. Understaffing problems start to go away. I've really almost only seen unions benefit workers, and management also quite often end up being on board and realizing that it's a good thing. It's a challenge. I think in Maine, it will be a challenge, and we'll see kind of what happens, but it's such a big state, and there are so many attorneys that are taking on court-appointed cases that are in different places, that are taking on such a wide range. There are some that just take on a few cases per month. There are some that take on, several hundred per year. And I think it's definitely doable. It's something that bigger states have formed, bigger geographically states have formed unions. And I'm excited to see sort of what happens over the next few years. But I think that if we really want this structural change in the system, it's going to take everyone collectively joining together and using our collective power to get what I think we deserve. And I think it will be good for everyone. So.
Yeah, and this is a great thing that I feel like a lot of people probably haven't thought about. So thank you so much for telling us about this, and it was great chatting.
Of course.
Thank you for listening to Justice Radio. Tune in next time, and a big thank you to Samuel James for his gift of music that opens and closes each episode in our series.